The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Everybody reads the script for the sixth round of the FA Cup, except perhaps Fred. The best player in the world right now, Kelechi Iheanacho, gets another two. This podcast has always backed him. Elsewhere, it's all relatively straightforward. The City, Chelsea and Southampton on their way to the semi-finals. In the Premier League, Newcastle hit new lows, if that's possible. There's lots of fun at the London Stadium. And did anybody watch the last half hour of Spurs' drab win at drab Aston Villa, or did we all switch over to Line of Duty? There's a Champions League draw to digest, glorious free kicks in France, hilarious own goals in Scotland, and worrying rumours of Football Weekly knockoff merch. Of course, we'll add in as many of your questions as we can, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Marcus Bean, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hey, Max, how are you?
And hello, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Dave says, can you introduce a sad story warning or start playing a jingle so we know it's coming? After Philippe Auclair's mummy story, then Wilson's Wembley tale, I don't want to be known as the crazy man who walks his dog with tears in his eyes. That's what you did, Wilson. It was a beautiful moment and we got a lovely reaction, didn't we?
We did, yeah. If I'd realised it was so easy to get people on your side, I'd have been crying for the last 20 years. I felt a bit like Dickie Bird, kind of performative northern crying.
Have you not seen those emotional backstories in The X Factor just before you have to sing a cover of Mike and the Mechanics?
No, obviously not.
Okay, of course.
Why would I watch The X Factor?
Anyway, let's start at the King Power, shall we? Leicester 3, Manchester United 1, Leicester City getting to the FA Cup semi-final for the first time in 39 years. Manchester United rested some players. Bruno Fernandes, Luke Shaw rested. Sam says, can Barry say Iheanacho is good now, please, and end all of this?
No, I still think he's underperforming. he could have scored more goals yesterday. I was very disappointed with him.
It's purely coincidental, you could argue, but it's slightly odd that you had a pop at Iheanacho, or you'd not really a pop, I suppose, just sort of questioned him. And then he has gone on this quite extraordinary run.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't say anything about him that wasn't true at the time. He was underperforming for Leicester and always has until very recently. We have always seen flashes of excellence, but never any consistency. And it wasn't entirely his fault, because Jamie Vardy was his automatic first choice for Leicester when they were playing one up front. And his opportunities came few and far between, you know, when Vardy was suspended or injured, basically. But now Brendan Rodgers is playing two up front, and Iheanacho is really making hay out of these opportunities he's been given. And it's happening at a brilliant time for Leicester, when they've suffered lost two of their best players through injury, Madison and Harvey Barnes. And Jamie Vardy is not scoring goals. He hasn't scored in eight. But Iheanacho has really stepped up, so fair play to him.
I really like those moments, Barry, where you just temporarily completely forget the footballer you're thinking of.
Yes.
And I enjoy the pregnant pause. But let's not draw attention to it. Jim says,
Others might, you know, step in and help me out, but no, you just watch me suffer.
Jim says, could Leicester's success with two up top bring it back on vogue? It's not exactly Quinn and Phillips, but it's proving effective. What do you reckon, Wilson?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen quite a bit, actually, over the last, say, 4 or 5 years, that when teams do play two up front, obviously it has a knock-on effect in midfield, but it can cause problems just because opposing defenders are so used to playing against one up front. So obviously if you've got two defenders against one central striker, one goes to the player and one can mop up behind. But if you have two there, then you don't have that spare man. Now, obviously, for the vast majority of our lifetimes, that was very standard. But I think it maybe is something that defenders have got out of the habit of doing. They've forgotten how to do. And so it can cause problems. I mean, I think Iheanacho's career is a really interesting sort of case study in how contingent careers can be. That, you know, he breaks through at City, looks an amazing finisher as a kid, and then he's just not a Guardiola-type forward. So he gets moved on. And then, as Barry says, you know, his opportunities at Leicester are necessarily limited by Vardy when they were playing one up front. And so he sort of drifted out of the picture. And I guess when you do get your opportunities in that kind of circumstance, there's a huge amount of pressure on you, and you've got one or two games to perform, and maybe you snatch at a chance and you miss and your confidence dips. But now he's back playing regularly with confidence. Yeah, he looks the player we thought he could be 5 or 6 years ago, and it's great to see.
Marcus, on the subject of two up front and perhaps broadening it out, and I don't want to, take away from Wilson's life's work, but as a player, how key is the formation to you? I see you, Marcus, as a 4-4-2 man, start to finish with your career, and tell me if I'm wrong. But like when you're playing and you got two up top, how much of a difference does that make to the team that you're playing in, or if you have a three in the centre of midfield versus a two, like that seems such an obvious thing to be a problem.
Yeah, I think as a midfielder, it's I always prefer playing a three against a two. I think you've definitely got a major advantage there. And if you're not controlling the midfield 3v2, then something's very wrong, in my opinion. In terms of going with the two up front, I think that with defenders, it's very difficult, as Jonathan alluded to. I think they're so used to playing against a one. When you start putting two up front, I think it has an impact on the whole back four. So not just the two centre-halves, full-backs, what you see with Iheanacho and Vardy, they work really well together. Iheanacho would drop into the pockets, which then drags out a defender, which opens a channel up even more for Vardy. So it has a knock-on effect for the whole back four. And I think it's refreshing to see two up front.
And during a game, at halftime, if it's not working, would every player know it's not working because of this? Or are there some players who just are really good at football, just don't have a clue tactically what's happening?
I think every single player knows, when a formation's working or not. Even players that are, I'd say, not even football students of the game, and there's a lot of them out there, you'd be surprised. But one thing they do know is that when they're on the pitch and something's going wrong, they can feel it and sense it. And often at half time, it's very difficult to say to a manager, we need a change. But you can see everyone be looking at each other thinking, come on, Gaffer, we do something about this. Do you know what I mean?
Could you just stand in like a formation as a kind of hint?
Yeah. Don't think that'd go down very well.
James says, is there a better central defence in world football right now than Soyuncu, Evans and Fofana? Throw in Ndidi shielding and Tielemans distribution, it's a genuinely world-class spine. James, the biased Leicester fan.
Yeah, he's not far wrong. I mean, they have all five players he mentions there, and you can throw Kasper Schmeichel in as well, who's been great, have been outstanding for Leicester this season. Indeed, he's a class act. Wesley Fofana has been a great acquisition, and he's still only a teenager, I think. Johnny Evans has always been a class act, and, he was a steal for Leicester. I don't really understand why Louis van Gaal actually got rid of him from Manchester United. That continues to baffle me, but, Louis's his own man, makes his own decisions. And Tielemans has been a revelation as well. So, yeah, they are brilliant. There's no weak link there that I can think of.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mentioned about the three against two in midfield, and watching that game against Man United, it was incredible how easy it was for the Leicester two, Ndidi and Tielemans, to completely dominate that game. It goes to show maybe the squad depth at Man United isn't as good as maybe we all think it is, in the sense that they made four or five changes, and that midfield was just not capable of controlling the game against two in midfield. And Solskjaer will be very disappointed with that.
Sam says, what's quicker, the tectonic movement between the Eurasian and North American plates, or the central midfield partnership of Fred and Matic? Mark says, I know, Max, that you only play for Poly Fours, but are you better than Fred? I know he gave that ball away, Jonathan, and that was an inadvisable thing to do. But he's not that bad, is he? Or is he?
I think he's probably better than you, if that's the question. there were moments towards the end of last season, I think, when Fred started to look like the player United thought they'd signed. and you start to see the whole logic behind it. But he does make mistakes. Obviously, there was the game against PSG in the Champions League when he, you know, his red card had been signposted about an hour in advance and it inevitably arrived, which had profound consequences for United in terms of going out of the Champions League. And it's not just the first goal he gave away with the back pass yesterday. It's also, I think, the second goal. I mean, I know Matic, it looks terrible because he's sort of just watching the pass go around him. But why is he so isolated? Why isn't nobody there helping him? Why is Fred so far away from him? It just sort of seems to... I mean, I know Matic's lack of pace and his sluggishness on the turn is an issue. But I sort of think if the opportunity is there for somebody to play the 1-2, there's not a huge amount that player can do if he doesn't have the other midfielder covering across. And Fred's miles away. Fred's so far away that when he then tries to get back to make the foul, he can't even make the foul. He's lunging after him, sort of desperately reaching with his arms and can't get close enough to even bring him down.
Yeah, I think Fred's an interesting one because I think he's probably Man United's arguably best midfielder, but he's still a long way off, in my opinion, the level that they're going to need if they're trying to win the title, in the sense of you look at Fernandinho, Fabinho, these players have not only got high energy levels, read the game well, but technically they're excellent as well. And I think Fred lacks a little bit technically, especially if you're trying to be a team that's going to play out from the back. Those incidences of him losing the ball, he loses the ball far too often in dangerous areas.
Just to confirm, you mean sort of best holding midfielder? You're not including Bruno Fernandes in there just before somebody yells at you?
Exactly, yeah, exactly, thanks.
Anyway, Manchester United did get through to the Europa League quarterfinals after a 1-0 win in Milan. Gave them that 2-1 aggregate win. They'll play Granada in the quarterfinals. Manchester City got through against Everton. They took their time. Carlo Ancelotti saying we competed well for 80 minutes against, in my opinion, the best team in the world. They're through to their third successive semi-final. 14 points clear in the league, in the Carabao Cup final, in the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Do you know what question's coming, Barry?
I think I do, yes.
Well, what do you reckon? When do we start taking it serious? Hang on, did I do that last pod? Am I contractually obliged every pod now to talk about the quadruple for Manchester City?
Well, you have a history of repeating yourself, so go for it.
Okay, so if I gave you a pound to bet on whether they would or they wouldn't get the quadruple, where would the pound go? Barry's pound quadruple challenge, which is the way we can run this from now until they can't do it.
The pound would go into my pocket and stay there. I don't think they'll win the quadruple, sorry.
All right. And is that because they might play Bayern in the semi-final of the Champions League or because Chelsea in the FA Cup?
Spurs will beat them, won't they? And Jose will be insufferable.
I don't know. I really don't think he will.
No, he will. Of course he will. Spurs will win that. Jose will be insufferable. Their fans will be insufferable. That tin pot cup and ugh.
Will it be better for Spurs to win the Carabao Cup so that we don't have to talk about the quadruple anymore?
I would rather just talk about nothing else but the quadruple for the next 2 months than Spurs win the Carabao Cup. If I was only allowed to talk, I wasn't allowed to utter a word that wasn't related to Manchester City's chance of winning the quadruple for the next 60 days, so be it. I will do that if that's what it takes.
Fernandinho was brilliant, I thought, in that game.
Yes, he was sort of waltzing past players like Maradona, wasn't he?
Well, I love Fernandinho. He's one of my favorite players of all time. I'm not saying he's one of the greatest players of all time, but I just love watching him play. He just does what he does incredibly well. I liked him at Shakhtar, and now, I mean, it's eighth season at City, but so sort of understatedly brilliant. And you sort of think, I mean, he turns 36 next month, I think, or maybe in May anyway. He's nearly 36. And you sort of wonder when are his legs going to go? And he obviously has been less involved this season. I think he's only played 8 league games this season. And so you always wonder kind of, you know, has he still got it? Yeah, he absolutely still has it. Maybe not every week, but for one-offs. And it wasn't just protecting the back two, which actually is what allows Laporte to go forward, which brings the breakthrough in the end. It's Fernandinho sitting there. But just watching him, the way he's always in, he's always got 10 yards of space around him. He's always offering that option. And then as the game went on, he started taking the ball past people. You know, he set up that chance when he drove down the left for Sterling. I just think he's a fantastic player. We probably should appreciate while we still can.
In unexpected bursts from central midfield, his wasn't quite as unexpected as Declan Rice towards the end of that, when he suddenly turned into George Weah. Anyway, we'll get on to that game. Chelsea through as well. They beat Sheffield United 2-0. Ollie Norwood's own goal, Hakim Ziyech with the other. Fourth semi-final in 5 years for Chelsea. Seven consecutive clean sheets for Thomas Tuchel. What did you make of Jordan Jarrett-Bryan on the last pod? Saying, however, it's just sort of finding them boring, Chelsea. Is that a very, Marcus, you're shaking yes, an unfair criticism?
I think that's, yeah, very unfair, to be honest. I think it depends on what you like. I think the way they dominate the ball, they're always trying to attack. It's not like they're sitting back or like maybe a Jose team, or it's relentless, in my opinion. I think that they break you down because you have to concentrate for 90 minutes against them because they're always in possession. They're always probing. They're probing. Nothing about what I've when I watch them says to me that they're boring.
David McGoldrick missed quite the chance for Sheffield United in this game. It's kind of summed up their season in a way. Why are you laughing, Barry?
Oh, no, I'm just laughing because I'm replaying it in my head and it's... horrific.
It sort of made me quite sad, you know. It wasn't like I'm going to laugh at that miss. I just felt sad about it. Anyway, he'll be okay. Bournemouth 0, Southampton 3. This, Barry, was very comfortable, wasn't it?
Yeah, Bournemouth didn't bring much to the party, really. They were a pretty pathetic effort, I thought, from them. Nathan Redmond turned into George Best for the afternoon, which was kind of weird. I mean, he's generally a solid 6-7 out of 10 man, but yeah, that was a performance straight out of the top drawer from him, and Bournemouth made life very easy for Southampton.
I think Bournemouth had a lot of injury problems, just to be fair to Jonathan Woodgate's men.
Oh, fair enough.
So the semi-final draw then, Chelsea, Manchester City, Leicester v Southampton. Jonathan Wilson, what will the final be, and what will the final score of the final be?
It will be Manchester City 1, Leicester 1, with Manchester City winning on penalties.
Okay. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we do the relegation battle, what a fun game at the London Stadium. Kieran saying, does Arteta not understand the Arsenal DNA? They're supposed to go 3-0 up and then blow it to draw or lose, not the other way round. I miss the old Arsenal. Marcus, this was great fun, wasn't it?
No, it was a fantastic game, man. I thought first time West Ham were excellent, out of the blocks quickly, pressured hard, were on the front foot, and Arsenal were just so abject. It was incredible. I don't know if it was tiredness, maybe, but it was lack of, real lack of enthusiasm. It was really poor. Second half, again, I don't know why teams do this. West Ham drop off deep and just invite pressure. It was relentless. And when you've got to keep attacking. That's the best form of defence. And especially against teams of the quality of Arsenal, if you invite that much amount of pressure, they will score. And then it was just, yeah, well, fair play to Arsenal for coming back.
We were quite critical of West Ham last week, saying this, you know, it's David Moyes' natural inclination to be overly cautious. And I don't know if Jacob Steinberg heard us or was just musing anyway, regardless, but he more or less went on Twitter and torpedoed everything we said out of the water, saying that it would have been suicidal for them to be less cautious against Manchester United. But I'm going to stick to my guns. I couldn't agree more with what Marcus said there.
I think in the specifics of the United game, because of the injuries they had, I sort of understand it a bit more. But my problem with Moyes for a long time, and obviously he's done way, way better than I expected to do this season, but when he was at Everton, when he was at Sunderland, when he was at at West Ham, it's always get a lead, cling on to it. And like, I haven't looked at the stat for 3 or 4 months now, but there definitely was a point when West Ham had lost more points in the final 10 minutes than any other team. I suspect Tottenham have now surpassed that. When he was at Sunderland, kept on. I mean, there weren't many points to lose, but there were a substantial proportion lost in the last 10 minutes. And you could see it happening from 3-0. You could see the kind of a Moyes sit back. You sort of think, well, it just, I don't know, it just feels a very old-fashioned way of defending, a way that doesn't really work anymore because of how modern football is and changes to the laws. And they've had a brilliant season. He's done a brilliant job. But that can't be denied. But that it's, you know, it's like the scorpion on the turtle, isn't it? You know what I mean? The kind of,
it's in his nature.
There's a scorpion that asks for this a lift across the river on the back of the turtle, and the turtle says, "Yeah, but you're just going to sting me." And the scorpion says, "No, I won't." And halfway across, the scorpion stings the turtle, and the turtle's sort of dying, and the scorpion's about to drown. And why did you do that? It's just in my nature. That's Moyes with a lead.
He's not that kind of scorpion. So I'm not that kind of scorpion.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, traditionally, that story is about a scorpion and a frog, because would the scorpion be able to penetrate the turtle's shell?
Around the neck. That's the way your turtle's always vulnerable, around the neck.
Is that right? I would say, in West Ham's defence, you're not clinging on to a lead if you go 3-0 up. I mean, you're clinging on if you keep it at 1-0 or maybe 2. Like they kept. At what point do you stop clinging on? Like at 5-0, surely you can just go, all right, this is probably done. The funny thing with West Ham, I think, is I just can't work out if they're good. Like, I keep watching them. They keep winning matches and scoring goals. But well, I don't watch them at any point and think, this is a great football team. And maybe that's just a sort of an inherent subconscious sort of, I'm watching West Ham, so they can't be good. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, there is a danger here that it sounds like I'm sort of demeaning what West Ham have done this season. I don't mean to do that. They had a brilliant season and they totally deserve to be where they are in the league. However, there's a lot of their wins have been by a single goal. And if you look at Sheffield United last season, when a lot of their wins were by a single goal, you're playing with quite fine margins. So there's the potential
to get relegated next season.
For it to go quite badly wrong quite quickly. Clearly, they are a better side than Sheffield United. Clearly, that is the case. But I'd be slightly uneasy if I were a West Ham fan by just how many of those games are by a single goal.
Did we ever think we'd see the day when we'd be sitting on this podcast criticising West Ham for not winning by enough?
No, but only being fifth. And look, Antonio hits the post with one of those sort of Gazza studs type moments, which changes this whole discussion, I guess. For Arsenal, Marcus, Martin Odegaard was brilliant, wasn't he?
It was an unbelievable performance. I thought, technically, he's a joy to watch. We spoke about it before, about players finding space in Fernandinho. He's a player that always seemed like he's got so much time on the ball. He's happy to receive it in tight areas. He dictates the play. He's their go-to man now. He reminds me of Ozil a little bit. And it's a bit interesting. It's interesting how heavily Ozil's criticised, but yet Arsenal fans are purring over Odegaard because they're both left-footed. They both like to stay on the ball. They both like to try and slip people in the final third. And they're both technically excellent. So, yeah, listen, if they can make it permanent, it's something that Arsenal, I think, should definitely do.
Arsenal progressed in the Europa League on Thursday, 3-2 over Olympiacos, despite losing the second leg 1-0. They'll play Slavia Prague in the quarterfinal. We'll go on to that game in part three. Brighton 3, Newcastle 0. Newcastle boss Steve Bruce has the full support of owner Mike Ashley, according to the papers over the weekend. Steve Bruce said he took, quote, full responsibility for the defeat, but added he will never give up the fight. It's got a good amount of cliches in this section so far. Ryan Fraser said the mood is the lowest it's been and the club need to save their season. I haven't read yet, but I presume someone said we've got 10 cup finals now.
Given Newcastle's record in cup finals, that's disastrous news.
Sean says Newcastle have won 2 games in 20. The owner thinks that's absolutely fine, and the pundits still get away with trotting out BS like the fans expect too much. Is wanting a competently run club with a tiny modicum of ambition too much? Is it silly to want rid of a horrendous manager? Hold on a second.
Sorry.
No, that's okay, Barry. Yeah, I am. I'll hold on.
It is a cliche that pundits trot out garbage about wanting Newcastle fans wanting too much. Pundits don't do that. I can't remember the last time I heard a pundit saying Newcastle fans have expectations that are too high. But they keep coming on with this absolute bollocks about the media thinking they want to be in the Champions League, or they expect to be in the Champions League. They expect to be in the, you know, contesting the Premier League. Nobody thinks that.
So the cliche is not the cliche that the pundits are trotting out. The cliche is the fans saying the pundits are saying the cliche that they're not saying.
Exactly.
They weren't very good, Jonathan, were they?
Oh, they were dreadful. Absolutely pitiful. I mean, I've seen some bad Newcastle performances, and that's really up there. That was, I mean, utterly terrible. I mean, when you make Brighton look like a free-scoring, happy-go-lucky team who could rack up four or five every week, then you know something's badly, badly wrong. I mean, Brighton, I think, have only won two games by more than a single goal this season, both of them 3-0 wins over Newcastle. So that's not a great sign. I mean, how many did Newcastle have? Something like three shots in the entire game. It was almost unwatchable because it was so one sided. You know, a game I'd sort of gone into thinking this is quite an interesting kind of Saturday evening treat, a relegation battle between two teams who desperately need it. Well, you wouldn't know that if you came into the game without any context. You know, you would think that Newcastle was safe mid table and on the beach.
Based on the players, though, do we think that any manager could do much better than Steve Bruce? Because the players they've got out there, I just don't think are good enough, if I'm honest. I think the tools that he's got to work with are blunt, especially up front and in attacking areas.
But he didn't actually pick a striker for this game. Like the must-win game, he goes without a striker, then makes three substitutions and still doesn't bring on a striker. You had Andy Carroll and Dwight Gale on the bench, and on the bench is where they stayed. That just seems remarkable. And then he played Isaac Hayden out of position. He's just weird tactics, or a complete lack of tactics. It was diabolically bad.
Consecutive wins for Brighton, and Barry, they scored. Trossard and Welbeck scored the same goal, which was nice. And they were lovely strikes. And I'm sure a Brighton fan will get annoyed that we spent this whole chat talking about Newcastle, hence me bringing it up.
Well, we have spoken at great length about how good Brighton can be in recent podcasts, but scoring goals was their problem. They have faced very obliging opponents in their last two games. And you would imagine they have enough about them to stay up. You know, now that they're scoring goals, whether Newcastle can, I don't know if Newcastle will get relegated. Every indication is that Fulham are a better side than Newcastle, even though they're beneath them in the table. And Newcastle have a very difficult run in. And I think Newcastle, Fulham play each other on the last day of the season, but I suspect Fulham will be well clear of Newcastle by that point, although their recent form has been worrying.
If I were director of football at Newcastle, I would stack Steve Bruce and I'd get Sam Allardyce in, and I'd say to Sam, you preserve your record of not being relegated to the Premier League club, and there is a sense you might have unfinished business at this club. And just see, I mean, can you imagine the emotional turmoil the Newcastle fans when they have to celebrate Sam Allardyce keeping them up?
It's a brilliant idea. You mentioned Fulham there. They lost to Leeds on Friday night. I suppose, you know, and this was a game of fine margins, wasn't it? I think Leeds were probably better, but Lookman misses that chance and then Leeds go down the other end and score. Is there a danger, Marcus, that we will keep saying until the end of the season that Fulham are just a really good team, so they're obviously not going to get relegated. Then they'll actually be relegated and we'll still be saying, but Fulham are a really good team and they're not going to get relegated.
I think there's a real danger. I think with Newcastle being so poor, unless something changes there dramatically, I think that Fulham will have enough to stay up. But yeah, they need to start turning some of these performances into results. But they have got enough quality in their team to do that, I think so.
Gareth Southgate said Patrick Bamford was very close to getting a call-up for the England squad. I was a bit sad. I inherently I like his movement and his style. His finish was lovely. His assist was beautiful in this game as well. I was a bit sad that he didn't make the squad. Do you think Jonathan Ollie Watkins over Bamford is a sensible decision? Or, you know, in the grand scheme of things, if England want to win the Euros, it doesn't make any difference?
I think it's a 50-50 call. Whichever of the two were left out, I think would have reason to feel disappointed. And, you know, this is the issue we've talked about, that there's so many options for Southgate that whoever he picks, there's going to be, you know, half a dozen really good players left aside. I mean, you've seen the reaction with Trent Alexander-Arnold being left out. And yet, I think on form, you have to say that, I mean, maybe Kyle Walker would be my question. But then Kyle Walker can play on the right of three centre-backs, so he gives you that option. But on form, Trippier is playing better and Reece James is playing better. So the sort of the outrage from some sections of the media at Alexander-Arnold's omission, you know, I think is a worrying sign of things to come. And I think, you know, really, it just depends on whatever conversation Southgate had with Alexander-Arnold. I mean, if he rang him up and said, look, I don't think you're playing great at the minute, have a couple of weeks off and recharge yourself, well, great. I mean, I acknowledging that Alexander-Arnold, I think the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks has looked a bit better than he had done. But I don't think having sort of 10 days off at this stage is a bad thing for him at all. As long as Southgate has sort of said to him, look, this is not necessarily permanent, you get your form back and you're back in.
Had Southgate just WhatsApped Trent with "no place for you, lol," and then, you know, a downwards thumb emoji, that would be possibly not the way to go.
Well, look, I don't know Alexander-Arnold. Maybe he responds to that, but it's not what I would do.
Can we pay tribute to Peter Lorimer, Scotland international, Leeds record goal scorer, 238 goals and 705 appearances during two spells with them, among other trophies, two league titles, an FA Cup, a League Cup. Louise Taylor wrote a lovely tribute in the paper, known as Hotshot or Thunder Boots or Lash. She writes, Peter Lorimer struck the ball so hard, it seemed almost surprising his shots did not leave vapour trails as they flew inexorably towards the back of numerous nets. Wilson, if you watch some of his goals, I mean, it seems so base to say, God, he could kick it hard, but wow, his strike was just amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think of that era, you'd say him and Bobby Charlton were the two best strikers best British strikers of a football. You know, clearly a huge part of Leeds' success in the 60s and 70s. I mean, from my point of view, famous for having the shot that was saved by Jim Montgomery as the second part of a double save in the 73 FA Cup final. And I saw Jim Montgomery, who's not well at all at the minute, but it was nice to see him paying tribute to Lorimer. But, you know, they did a lot of after-dinner speaking things together. But, yeah, and one of that strange generation of Scottish players who didn't really play for Scotland very much. I think he only got 20-odd caps, despite being a brilliant player, partly because there were so many good Scottish players and partly because there was a reluctance to pick Scottish players who moved to English clubs. But yeah,
I think he took a summer off and played for Cape Town City in apartheid South Africa, and wasn't picked for that reason for a while, but then was brought back in the 1974 World Cup, is what I read about this morning.
I mean, a lot of players went and played in the part of South Africa in the 70s, so I'm not saying that makes it right, but he wasn't alone in that. And yeah, he was a... I mean, I think when you hear about his shot, it's easy to think he was the out-and-out centre-forward, but he tended to play just off Alan Clark or whoever. And you see... I mean, his volleying technique particularly, I think you see... Yeah, just how hard he could strike it.
And it's been a tough time for Leeds to lose him, Jack Charlton, Trevor Cherry, Norman Hunter, all in a very short period.
The thing that was said about that side was that they all sort of grew up together, and one of the huge problems they had in the 70s was that they all sort of came to the end together. And unfortunately, over the last year or so, we're really seeing the truth of that. They were all the same age, and so they are all dying at the same time. So, yeah, it's... it's a very sad time for Leeds to lose so many legends in such a short space of time.
There was a lovely story from Louise Taylor going, during that time, he joined Bobby Charlton and Francis Lee on a newspaper-sponsored visit to a Midlands munitions factory. The idea was to prove conclusively that Lorimer could hit the ball harder than anyone else, and a series of shots were tested by a machine more commonly used to measure the velocity of bullets. And Peter Lorimer won. Also, at one point, struck a penalty that was measured at 107 miles an hour. Our thoughts are obviously with his family and his friends. Peter Lorimer passed away at the age of 74. Back to the Premier League. Spurs won 2-0 at Aston Villa. Is that enough, Barry, to paper over the cracks of what happened on Thursday night in Zagreb?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Villa are clearly missing Jack Grealish. It's Jose's sort of MO is to, rather than focus on what his team does, focus on what the other team is going to do. And without Jack Grealish in the side, he has a lot less to worry about. And it was a pretty straightforward win.
Yeah, I mean, Villa were the better side until Spurs scored. Harry Kane was brutally scythed down for...
Matty Cash horror tackle. National treasure, Harry Kane.
Quite a few people tweeting, you know, oh, this is tech, go, you know, biting aside, how are Harry Kane's actions on the pitch any different to Luis Suarez? How can one shithousery masterclass be abhorred while the other excused?
I think Harry Kane does it with a smile on his face, so that's why he gets away with it.
Was it a foul? I mean, I couldn't...
Yeah.
It's a foul.
I think it's a foul, but he's manufactured it. Listen, I think, personally, if you go down to ground in that fashion in the box, you're going to give away a penalty, you know, and you make contact as a penalty, but yeah, he's 100% manufactured that. The ball's going one way, and he's kind of, as he's done many a time, he kind of, you know, goes a complete opposite way. It's not nice to see, but the distance he's moved isn't that much, so I think it's a penalty.
Yeah, look, it's the Paul Doyle rule. If that's, it's not denying a goal-scoring opportunity, just make that a free kick.
Yeah.
No one's unhappy, yeah. And football would be better. Adam says, is anything a worse representation of modern football than paying a social media company to put up stuff like job done or we go again? It's not like Descartes being employed. They're paying companies to put up stuff my dog could think of. This is in relation to Joe Hart's Instagram post after the 3-0 defeat by Dinamo Zagreb. One of his social media people just wrote job done, which is entirely accurate because they were done by Mislav Zorsic hat trick. Despite their manager being sentenced to 4 years, 8 months in jail 2 days before the game, Joe Hart said, morning, guys. I feel like I need to make an apology on behalf of my social media team. It's just been brought to my attention. Someone thought we'd won 3-0 last night, which is sloppy as it sounds, but it's the truth. And then he said, have a great day, everyone. Not so easy for Tottenham fans after getting thrown out of the tournament. Hugo Lloris is interviewed afterwards. Wilson was sort of quite telling in a way.
Very telling. I can't remember many other interviews quite as revealing. Calling it a disgrace, okay, you sort of occasionally see that. The players are just sort of appalled at the whole setup. But then to sort of say, there's no unity in the squad, we can't rely on the players who are not in the first team to support us, which I think seemed pretty pointed at probably 3 or 4 players. Whoever that was aimed at, it's not a sign of a healthy dressing room at all. And you just sort of feel that we're entering the Mourinho doom spiral. Well, we've been in the Mourinho doom spiral for some time, but it's approaching terminal velocity. And I guess the Carabao Cup final is the thing that they're waiting for. Or I don't know, maybe the payment that Tottenham have to make to Mourinho would go down if he gets to the end of the season. I don't know. But I guess the question against that is, what do you lose if you don't get in the Champions League when you might have had a chance to be in the Champions League?
They're 3 points off fourth. I mean, that's sort of baffling given how terrible they've been recently.
Well, I mean, they were top, weren't they, 3 months ago? And I guess there's a lot of teams who are not having great seasons between sort of fourth and tenth. So it's all a bit of a mess around there.
Did Dan Brown write the Mourinho doom cycle?
I mean, I would read it if he had.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of his others, but I would read that one.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. We'll begin part three talking about the alleged racist abuse that Glenn Kamara suffered when playing on Thursday night in Slavia Prague. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the alleged racist abuse of Glenn Kamara by Slavia Prague's Andre Kudela on Thursday night in the Europa League. It was the 87th minute of the game. Kamara's version of events is that Cadell was arguing with a Rangers player, and after I tried to intervene, he told me to shut up. And then he said, 1 second, my friend. He then came over to me, covering his mouth, leaning into my ear. He uttered the words, You're a fucking monkey. You know you are. Kamara also claims one of his Rangers teammates heard the remark. Slavia, in a statement, said he, Kudela, categorically denies and refutes any allegations of racism. We are shocked that his reputation and the club's reputation are being smeared without a single piece of evidence. Slavia asserted that Kudela said, quote, you're a fucking guy, to Kamara. Slavia Prague also say they filed a criminal complaint for an alleged brutal assault on Andre Kudela after Thursday's game. Police Scotland said they've not been contacted. Rangers haven't commented on the matter. Kamara said, as a player, I do not expect myself nor any other to have to tolerate racial hatred on or off the pitch in 2021. The vile racist abuse by Andre Kudela took place on the international stage, and any failure to act by UEFA will be viewed as a green light for racism. In the aftermath of that, a section of Slavia Prague fans posted a banner on social media containing a racial slur at Kamara. Slavia Prague condemned that banner. It had the N-word on it. UEFA confirmed an ethics and disciplinary inspector had opened an investigation into incidents during the match at Ibrox. It is a depressing story, Barry, and it depends on the burden of proof. If it's on the balance of probability, you know, people don't react like that. We don't know what happened, so it's difficult to sort of categorically decide either way, but on the balance of probability, you well, imagine...
On the evidence of what I've seen, I know what I think happened, but it's hard to prove, and UEFA are famously lenient when it comes to punishing incidents of racism, and famously quick to sweep them under the carpet. And it's not good enough, it's never been good enough, but it's how they continue to operate.
There's a video circulating on social media whereby the Rangers player Bongani Zungu overhears what's been said and immediately remonstrates to the referee, repeats what's being said. You could see visibly how upset Kamara was. Listening to Stephen Gerrard's interview, who I thought handled it brilliantly. I was really proud that he was captain of my club at one stage, and he's obviously going to be a great manager because he's a leader of men. He clearly came across like that. He was upset himself, and you could see that how much he gets on with Kamara. He obviously respects him as a person, and that's what racism should do. It should hurt everybody.
The other thing I thought was interesting is it feels like a lot of people find it easier to yell about how bad racism is in Eastern Europe than when it happens on our doorstep. You know, almost like, oh, look, it's not as bad here as it is in Eastern Europe. Right? What we've seen here is bad. You know, the reaction of the Slavia Prague fans who've held up that banner is fucking outrageous. But it almost makes us sort of feel like, oh, look, at least it's not as bad here, even though it is really terrible here. We've seen it's terrible here on social media.
Yeah, it is very bad here on social media. But I think England is racism's different. It's not as in your face in England. It's more behind closed doors and in the higher echelons of, I don't know, whether it be politics or companies. It's more like that. It's not as in your face. But listen, social media is awful. But I think in those countries, you know, I think you might be able to, it's more, as I said before, it's more, yeah, in your face.
On the pitch, Celtic and Rangers drew 1-1. The draw means Rangers cannot match Celtic's 106-point haul in their unbeaten 2016-17 campaign. Let's talk about the Champions League draw. Bayern Munich, PSG, Wilson. That is a fun one, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, last year's final, I thought then that Bayern's high line might get exposed by Mbappe. Because Bayern was so good in midfield, that didn't happen. But you look at how Bayern are defending at the minute. I think they've let in 35 goals in 25 Bundesliga games, which for a team who are top of the table is obviously a lot. So you think they may be, you know, that vulnerability we thought might be shown in the final could be there again. But I mean, yeah, I'd say they are two of the four best sides in Europe at the moment, and fascinating to see them against each other.
The winner of that game plays the winner of Manchester City, Borussia Dortmund. And you have to start asking the question now, Barry, whether Manchester City... Real Madrid, Liverpool, what do you reckon, Marcus?
I'm pretty confident. I think we can get... hopefully Henderson will be back by then. I think... listen, the front three against Real Madrid's back four, if they can, you know, pull their finger out, I think can cause a lot of trouble. I think the two centre-halves are looking a little bit more steady with Fabinho sat in front of them. Yeah, I think got a good chance of going through from that. And what we do know is that Klopp's going to now take that as really seriously, and he's going to make sure that everyone's fit and ready for that game, even if he's got sacrificed the Premier League.
And the other one is Porto. The winner of that game will play the winner of Porto versus Chelsea. Wilson, is everybody writing Porto off too soon?
Possibly. I mean, they've been really, really good, I think. I mean, they only let in one goal, I think, in the group stage. They kept a clean sheet against City, which is obviously very difficult to do. I thought for three of the four halves against Juve, in the normal time halves, they were by far the better side. The way they kept posing a threat, even after going down to 10 men, I thought was hugely impressive. So I don't think there's going to be many goals in that game, but I think that's a... Chelsea should come through it, but I think it'll be tight, and I think it could be a really interesting game.
Well done to Bono, the Sevilla goalkeeper, who scored against Real Valladolid. Went up for a corner, abject defending, and he scored the equaliser, hammered it home. Richard Jolly stat. Bono, the first member of U2 to score since Adam Clayton struck in Middlesbrough's 2-0 win over Huddersfield in November 2015. Has everyone seen this free kick by a Lorient player from a mile out?
Yes.
Which I thought was glorious. Felix sent a tweet, not addressed to me, in fact, addressed to the other people, but somehow it appeared on my feed. Knuckleball has no place in football, only possible because Sports Direct beach balls. Who even is this lottery shot fluke fancier? Insult to Rivellino, Carlos, Quaresma, Cubillas, and all other genuine leather whisperers. Wilson?
Yeah, I think in the long term, it's going to be a really, really bad thing for Lorient, because he will now just, every time they get a free kick in the opposition half, he'll go, yeah, I'll have a pop. And it'll be like Roberto Carlos. For the next 5 years, he'll be smashing the ball into the wall, blazing it over the bar. I mean, free kicks are weird, right? They're kind of... There's actually not very many have ever scored. So I think Sinisa Mihajlovic is the leading scorer of free kicks in the big five leagues. And I think he only ever scored 29.
Mm. Yeah, hasn't James Ward-Prowse got 29 this season?
I think he's got like four.
It's as good as a penalty when James, that's what commentators say.
Yeah, okay, here's a question for you. There was a player in the Premier League who once scored 4 out of 7 free kicks.
Yeah.
Which is the most consistent run since Opta began collecting the stats.
Yeah.
Who was it?
Yaya Toure.
Is correct, because he was on that same thread.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I thought I'd give it enough of a pause so you'd think I was clever.
Listen, you shouldn't be scoring a free kick from there. I'm sorry. Like, even if I was in goal, they wouldn't score. I'd put my neck on the line and say, you wouldn't score for me from there.
Oh, you've gone a bit Roy Keane now, telling you a better keeper than the real keeper.
I have. But come on, like, from there, that's just insane. Yeah.
Well, I hope you signed for Nantes in goal now, and then we'll find out. Sean says, ask Marcus about the hand of Bean and why Gillingham fans hate him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so that was a cold, windy night, a Tuesday night at Gillingham. We hadn't won in, like, I was at QPR. We hadn't won in, like, I think it was the first 5 or 6 games of the season. And ball's been crossed in, and I basically punched it in. I hate to say it because I feel bad for it now, but punched it in. Everyone was going crazy. Hezen Tyler, who was actually player manager at the time, was just spitting mad.
Andy Hezen Tyler has been the player manager of Gillingham for the last 200 years.
It feels that way. It feels that way. But anyway.
Did you celebrate, Marcus?
I did celebrate, yeah. That was a young bean. I was pretty naive in those days. But afterwards, yeah, I kind of said that, yeah. I remember the manager saying to me, did you handball it? And I said, yeah, it was Ian Holloway at the time, and he was like, listen, like, he weren't happy, put it that way, because he is quite,
oh, really?
He's a very honest man, yeah.
Good old
yeah.
Ollie.
Yeah, he's very honest, so
did
he wasn't
you
happy.
You handball it, Marcus.
That wasn't a great impression, Barry, mate.
No, it was terrible. It was really bad. did you speak to the press after the game?
I did, and I told a little porky. I said, I don't think it hit my hand. I didn't mean it, but I did actually.
And was
mean
it proper? Like,
I did
proper
actually
just...
mean it. It was weird. I like kind of shot, rolled round, and then kind of punched it in. It was kind of, yeah, it was a definite handball. It's just, yeah, these days in VAR, it would have been ruled out immediately.
And what did the oppo say during the rest of the game? When you're running around?
Yeah, just in your ear. Just in your ear, just giving you stick the whole game, yeah.
I can't believe it, Marcus. How could you? Yeah. Would you like to apologise to the Gillingham fans now?
Yeah, well, sorry for Gillingham fans. Okay. Sorry, Gillingham fans.
Adam says, is Jonathan still sceptical about butternut squash? 12 months ago, he said it was too onerous to prepare, but we've all had a bit of spare time since then. And what do the other panellists think of butternut squash? Wilson.
I don't mind it. If I get sent it in my veg box, fine, I'll roast it and I'll deal with it. But it's a right hassle for the pleasure you get out of it. It's sort of 6 out of 10 pleasure, 8 out of 10 hassle butternut squash to prepare. It's not like a pomegranate. Pomegranate is the worst fruit or vegetable to get in your veg box. It takes forever and it's not even that nice.
This is not. It's fortunate there's no Mark Langdon, isn't there, on this?
it'd be like talking to me about music.
Joel says, on the subject of Football Weekly merchandise, have you considered a Ben Fisher Storytime shirt? I'm picturing a seated Ben reading a book called The Car Park with various members of the pod sitting on the floor, cross-legged, eagerly awaiting the story. It's a great idea. And ukulele road trips.
Oh, we could do... You're old enough to remember Jack and Ori, right?
Yes, yes.
And like, it was always, when Kenneth Williams was on, it was always exciting because he was so good at it. Mm-hmm. So you could have Jack and Ori audiobooks of Ben Fisher.
Oh, yeah, that's a really nice idea. There's some controversy from Ukulele Road Trips. You say you have no merch. Where did this come from? He has somehow chanced upon a mug with the new Guardian Football Weekly picture, which is... me looking adoringly at Barry and Barry looking like he'd rather be anywhere else. how do we feel about this?
Is that unlicensed merch?
It's unlicensed merch, yeah.
Making money off our hard work.
Should we sue them or do we have to wait until Brian Blessed sued us and then we can only do one court case at a time?
I have a friend who makes a very, very good living selling unlicensed merch outside band venues and, you know, outside concerts and whatnot. Obviously, he hasn't worked since for over a year now, but...
yeah, are you saying we could go to other podcast live shows, stand outside with unlicensed merch yeah. and sell it and make money? Yeah, I'd go and make 20 T-shirts, stand outside. Jimbo, stand outside. A little theatre. I think that would be really funny. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. Marcus, thanks for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Jonathan, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be back tomorrow doing a special on the relationship between football and climate change. So join us for that one.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.